Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. It seems a day doesn't pass where we don't hear about AI and how it's entering many aspects of our lives. One of those areas is grammar. People are depending on artificial intelligence, such as ChatGPT, to write business reports and help with homework assignments. But is the increased use of AI impacting our grammar? Joining us this hour is Mignon Fogarty, founder of Quick and Dirty Tips Network and the creator of Grammar Girl. She's also the author of many books about language, including the bestseller from the New York Times, Grammar Girl: Quick and Dirty Tips for Better Writing. Welcome back to All Sides, Mignon.
Amy, thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So AI is creeping into our lives, especially our writing. So as someone who teaches grammar for a living, what are the common hallmarks of AI that you can recognize whenever you look at some writing?
Yeah, this is a great question. I've been seeing on social media everywhere the last few days that dashes are a sign of AI writing. And I have to say that is ridiculous. I have been following the AI writing for, you know, probably 3 years now, because it does affect writers and editors so significantly. And I have never seen anything that says any study or anything like that that says dashes are a sign of AI writing. Now, there have been studies, though, that have shown that certain words can be a hallmark of AI writing. They appear more often in AI output than in output that you would see from people. And those are, I think of them as $5 words. Those are words that some of the top ones were: meticulous, strategically, commendable. You know, these big fancy words. AI loves those words. Delve. It's always delving into things.
AI loves to delve into a topic. Okay.
AI loves to delve.
So we're delving into grammar here.
We are. But the thing is, humans use those words too. So you can't look at a piece of writing and say just because it uses delve or strategically that it was written by AI. The words are in the output because the LLMs like ChatGPT, they were trained on human writing. That's, you know, the beginning of it all. And so those words were in a lot of the writing that they were trained on. So that's why they're there. So they appear more frequently in AI writing, but obviously humans use those words too. It's really when they show up in places where they aren't appropriate or wouldn't be expected that they can be more of a hallmark. You know, if a fifth grader is talking about something strategic or commendable or meticulous, you know, then maybe that, you know, again, like I wouldn't say 100% their essay is written by AI, but I might look a little deeper to see if it could have been.
When I read an email that where there's like 10 words in the sentence when like three would do, like you can tell it has, then sometimes that makes me think, I'm like, did AI write this?
Yeah. And it, I think that you can write elaborate prompts that will tell AI how to format your writing, what tone it should have. You know, you could even tell it use short sentences. And I think that you get these particularly AI sounding pieces when people are new to using it. So they don't know how to write sort of the more careful prompts, or if people are just, you know, using it quickly and aren't taking the time to give it all the input it needs to output something that is more more appropriate for the situation.
Now, I know a lot of writers, grammar purists at the start of AI were very anti, very skeptical. What do you think now? You know, you said you've been studying this for 3 years. Is AI helping writers or is it mostly a hindrance?
Yeah, many still are very skeptical. I'd say there can, in certain circles especially, there's a big stigma against using it. And it's such a big question whether it actually helps or is a hindrance, because the answer is it really depends. In some ways, these tools they're great levelers, because studies have shown actually that if you're an average writer, if you're a below average writer, they can really help you bring up the level of your writing, especially with respect to the mechanics, like getting the commas in the right place, getting it's with an apostrophe when you need one and it's without an apostrophe when you don't need one. You know, AI output really doesn't have those kind of errors. So it can help poor writers. Again, the studies have shown that if you're already a good writer to start with, they aren't really going to help you that much. So it's sort of leveling everything out. And, you know, I've heard business professors, for example, say they will no longer accept poor writing from their students. They just expect it all to be a certain level. You know, they may have, you know, made allowances for foreign students before, and now they're telling them, look, these tools are out there, like, let them help you. I don't want to read your bad writing. But then many, many other professors and especially teachers at the lower grades really don't want their students to be using these tools because, you know, students are supposed to be learning how to write. We still want them to learn how to write because, you know, writing, it isn't just the mechanics. It's also an important way we learn to reason and think and make an argument.
I was wondering about the mechanics, though, of it. I guess you can probably, I haven't tried this, but if we write on our website in AP style, we could ask AI to fix it, like say, can you change this to AP style or that kind of thing? I would guess it can do that.
Yeah, absolutely it can. It's quite good at transforming writing. So taking writing, you know, it can take something and you can say, okay, put this at a fifth grade reading level, and it can do that very well. You can say, change all the italics to things in quotation marks instead, or add serial commas, or take out serial commas. And it's quite good at those kind of simple manipulations of writing. You do still have to check it. It's not perfect, but it can save a lot of time. I know a lot of editors are using it to reformat references. So, you know, if you're working on a scientific journal article for someone and you have to change and you have like 100 references in the style of one scientific journal and they need to be in a different format for another scientific journal, it can very quickly make formatting changes. But you do have to check it because it will make errors, but it still does save time.
I wonder if you could train your own AI if you are a lover of the Oxford comma like I am, and I can tell it I want Oxford commas in all my writing.
You can actually. Yeah. You can give most of them, you can give custom instructions like that. Mm. Yeah.
So how do you feel about services such as Grammarly? Do they help improve writers or does it make them lazy? No, I don't want to. I mean, there's other services. That's just the one that comes to mind. You know, I don't want to single any service out, but.
Yeah, no, of course. It is the most popular by far. It's the most well-known.
Yeah.
It can certainly help you catch simple errors. Although, you know, I see a lot of mistakes there, too. I've seen Grammarly give a lot of inaccurate suggestions. You know, some are just plain wrong and some don't take into account the context. You know, for example, like there are time, it's not wrong always to use a sentence fragment. There are all sorts of things that are, you know, you would consider good writing, like novels or high level, you know, articles in magazines that might use a sentence fragment for emphasis. You could write like the sun was setting, period, a lantern on the horizon. You know, that a lantern on the horizon, that is a sentence fragment, but it's not bad writing. It's fine. And Grammarly would probably flag that and say, this is a sentence fragment. Do you want to turn it into a full sentence? You know, and again, I think it has, if you're a good writer, if you're confident in your skills, you're going to look at that and say, well, that's a bad suggestion. I'm going to ignore it. I think where it's a hindrance is where, you know, a lot of people who are just learning or are not confident in their own skills are going to say, well, Grammarly obviously must be right, so I'm going to accept that suggestion. And then it actually makes their writing less creative. It dampens their voice. It can make it actually worse.
So AI has, we've gone over in the past few minutes, we've gone over good and bad, but do you think that it's creativity and a distinctive voice are the biggest things that'll be missing if we lean more into AI over the next few years?
Yeah, it's so interesting because there have been studies that show, there was a study on human creativity, and they found that at first, when people had large language models like ChatGPT, Gemini, Claude, help them with creative tasks, initially they came up with more varied and creative ideas. Essentially, their output was more creative. But then when the AI was taken away later in the study, the people who had access to it were less creative than the people who had never had access to it. So it's almost like it, you know, creativity is a muscle and you have to use it. And if you don't, if you get into the habit of relying on AI for your creativity, that muscle, that creative muscle is going to atrophy. Now, there are some other really important negatives to AI that I feel like we do have to talk about. Mm-hmm. First of all, it will lie to you. So
okay.
It will tell you things that aren't true all the time. And you have to check everything it tells you. And the big problem is that it does so in a very credible way. The way it gives the output, it sounds confident and authoritative. And so you're going to read the output it gives you. If you ask, you know, if you use it as a search engine, it's going to tell you things and you're going to say, this sounds reasonable and accurate. And it's embedded in a bunch of other things that are accurate. So it can be very hard to pick out the parts that are wrong. A lot of people will say, I thought AI was great until I used it for something I knew a lot about. And then I realized, you know, it's just kind of, you know, BS. Mm. So it can save time. It can be great, but it can also be dangerous in that way. There are also climate implications. So it uses an enormous amount of energy.
The data centers in the back end that have to power it. Is that what you mean?
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. They're just building data centers at a breakneck speed. And
a lot of them are here in Ohio. Yes.
Yeah.
We're aware.
Oh, good. Yeah. So, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they're just, you know, straining the grid and just, you know, it's wild. Now, they do seem to be making gains on that front. They're getting more efficient. So that's good news. And then, you know, I think people need to consider the ethical issues because these tools there are a lot of lawsuits right now charging these companies with violating copyright, you know, in just earth-shatteringly large ways. They were, you know, built on, you know, databases of pirated books and things like that. They're being sued for copyright violation just right and left. And, you know, a lot of writers and artists are just furious with these companies and believe they have stolen their work to build these billion-dollar products.
Is what you mean? Like they feed in a whole romance novel series, like they scan the whole entire series in, and then they tell AI, write me another series where the characters are unicorns or something like.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then imagine like every book in the world or every book that's available digitally that they could have gotten their hands on. And, you know, you can say, you know, write something for me in the style of this author or that author. And it can often do it quite well. And writers and it's the same is true for image generating AI, you know, for making paintings or photographs and I think that's where a lot of the stigma comes from with using it, is that a lot of writers and artists just like despise these companies. So that's important to keep in mind, too, when you're thinking about using it.
So as the creator of Grammar Girl, someone who arguably loves grammar more than most, where do you think you're going to end up on AI? Are you going to be like cautiously optimistic, or are you going to be negative?
Well, I guess I think of myself as a very practical person, and I think it's a lost cause to try to fight it. I mean, it's just, you know, like studies show like recently 30% of employees are using AI on the job. 10% of those are using it daily. No matter what you think about it, I don't think it's going away. And so I think we need to just think carefully about how we're using it. You know, like I never use it frivolously. You know, I don't use it just for fun. I'm making sure that if I use it, there's the benefit outweighs the potential harm or risk. You know, that I don't use it to write jokes, you know, or things like that. And a lot of people do that. It's fun. You start using it and it can be very fun. And I think especially if you don't know these things about, you know, energy use and climate and, and the ethics of where it came from, you would never think that there's any reason at all not to use it. You know, it helps you do your job faster. But I'm extremely concerned about the lack of truth in the output. You know, that people getting information that isn't accurate. I think that's a huge risk and problem.
Yeah, I mean, you even see that whenever you Google something, where there's now almost every time whenever you Google something, there's like a paragraph that answers it at the top before you even click on any websites or do any research.
And for some reason, Googles are particularly bad. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, that's one reason people are moving to using ChatGPT for searches, because Google has gotten so bad. It's very frustrating.
Well, coming up, we're going to talk more with Grammar Girl. We're going to talk about word usage, and we're going to invite listeners to join us with some grammar questions. That is when All Sides continues in just a moment on 89.7 NPR News.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jarovich. This is 89.7 NPR News. When do you use which as opposed to the word that? Is it hanged or hung? There are a lot of grammar questions that come up in daily life, whether you're a writer or not. And if you have ever Googled, is it affect or effect, then you've probably stumbled upon Grammar Girl in your research. Still with us, Mignon Fogarty, founder of the Quick and Dirty Tips Network and the creator of Grammar Girl. She's the author of many books about language, including the New York Times bestseller Grammar Girl's Quick and Dirty Tips for Better Writing. Mignon, thanks again for being here with us.
Yeah, thank you.
And listeners, if you have a grammar question this hour, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. So I mentioned right there, affect starting with an A or effect starting with an E. Is this truly the number one reason people click on the Grammar Girl website?
Yeah, it has been for many years. Yeah, it's a very common question that people ask. And so when is a verb and when is a noun? Most of the time, there are exceptions. But so the membrane trick that I use is I think of a big raven sitting on top of a roof, big black raven, because the word raven has the word the letters A-V-E-N in it, which mm-hmm. stand for affect, verb, effect, noun. affect with an A is a verb, and it's an action. So, you know, the weather affected fourth quarter sales. That's using it with an A. That's A, it's an action, it's affecting something. And A, raven, is a verb, A-V-E-N. Effect with an E is usually a noun. So you could say the effect was lower sales. And a clue that you're talking about a noun is that you can put a word like the or an in front of it. You know, we talk about the tree, the road, the effect. You couldn't say the weather, the affected sales. Like, that doesn't work. So you know you've got the verb because you can't put the word the in front of it. So you have to figure out whether you're dealing with a noun or a verb. And then you can use raven, A-V-E-N, to say affect, verb, effect, noun.
Now, we talked a lot about AI in the first segment. If I use the wrong one and then I run it through a grammar corrector, will it fix it? The A and the E? Like, is that one of the things where they'll lie to me?
Yeah, no, that's the great thing. It is really good at that kind of thing. And so, you know, if you put, if you, you know, take an essay and put it through there and say, like, fix the grammar and make sure I'm using all the right words, like, it would catch that. I think Grammarly probably would, too, those simple things like that. So it's quite good at that.
Now, you have been running Grammar Girl for years, a lot of years, right? When did you start Grammar Girl?
It's been about 18 years.
18
yeah.
years. So a lot has changed in 18 years. There was even not the thought of this AI stuff 18 years
right.
ago. How have you adapted your business over the years to kind of meet people where they are and what they need with grammar now?
Yeah, well, I try to be everywhere people might want to get language information. And I've been doing a lot more video lately, you know, so I've been on TikTok and doing reels. And, the primary element of the business is the podcast. The Grammar Girl podcast was the first thing I started, and it's the thing that I have always done. Every week, there is a Grammar Girl podcast.
There's over 1,000 episodes.
Yeah, yeah, we had the big 1,000th anniversary last year. So yeah, so that's the core. But then, and I've written the books, and I think video is probably the biggest thing that we have added. And now the podcast is on YouTube every week too. So there's the Grammar Girl YouTube channel that has, the interviews that I do and the regular shows that I do, and we have shorts. I will say, I think because of AI, our web traffic has been declining, and a lot of small website owners particularly will tell you this, that it's affecting their business, that people are going to these tools to look up information instead of going to the web. And it is a big problem for people whose primary income comes from their website.
Now, you are a 5-time winner of the Best Education Podcast, so you're definitely doing something right there by keeping that going. So do you run out of ideas of how to come up with new podcasts? How do you come up with 1,000 different podcast ideas?
Yeah, I mean, you would think, right?
Right.
But there, I still get listener questions from topics that I haven't covered before. We've definitely expanded the world of topics that we cover. In the beginning, it was largely mechanics like hanged versus hung and dashes. And I do a lot more etymology stuff now that for me, it's more fun. The sort of isn't language cool kind of topics, I don't know, 10 idioms that have the word blue, things like that, that are just more fun, so we broaden the topics that we cover. I'm now interviewing language experts every week, and so that's really fun. When people have new language books out, they'll come on the Grammar Girl podcast. A couple of weeks ago, I interviewed a guy who runs a ghostwriting firm that hooks up ghostwriters with people who need books written, and we talked all about that industry. So, I'm talking to interesting people. It's also really fun to bring back the old topics, though. Mm-hmm. And if I can find a news hook, for an old topic, that's always really fun. Like in the in the intro, you talked about Wicked, the movie that a listener wrote in and said, I think this song in the movie might have a grammar error. And,
well, okay, so since you're bringing up Wicked, I'm going to jump ahead of my script
if
my board operator's ready here. So one of the biggest movies in recent memory is the film Wicked, and does the song have a grammatical error? Let's listen.
Maybe a lifestyle note.
So the wizard and I there, should it be the wizard and me or what is that? Is the wizard and I okay?
It is, but it's a little bit of a confusing sentence, and it lets us talk about subject versus object pronouns, which is an old topic that I've done before, but this is a new way to think about it. So, so here's an example of a line is, that's how we'll begin the wizard and I. And people are used to subject. So I is the subject pronoun and me is the object pronoun. Mm-hmm. And for the purposes of this discussion, you can just think the subject usually comes at the beginning of a sentence and the object usually comes at the end of a sentence. Not always, but most of the time. And that's why people, when they hear I at the end, They're like, that's not in the right place. That should be me. Mm. But the thing about this is it's a weird kind of structure where you have a double subject. So you say, that's how we'll begin. And we'll is the subject there. And then you say, the wizard and I. And that is repeating the subject in a different way. So you've got the pronoun, we'll, and then you name them, the wizard and I. Who are we? The wizard and I. So if you were to say the sentence in a more, standard English, boring English kind of way, mm-hmm. it would be, that's how the wizard and I will begin. Mm. Right. And so you plug it in there. And this is just not as pretty
for the song in that order.
Yeah. It's a poetic yeah. sentence structure that we aren't used to seeing every day. And so that was a really fun question to be an entry into talking about subject and object pronouns. And, it's really apparently Elphaba corrects Glinda's grammar a couple times in the movie, too. So she herself is a grammar.
Elphaba is a grammar nut. She says, Glinda says, wow, green goes good with pink. And Elphaba says, it goes well with pink. And then Glinda says, it really does. So she doesn't even notice that her grammar is being corrected. But it should be, instead of green goes good with pink, it should be green goes well. Is that
exactly
a proper correction? Okay.
And that's why my listener was so horrified that then they might have had Elphaba singing a grammatically incorrect song. But...
right. Oh, because she's a grammar nut. So she should. So, yes. But she was correct by saying the wizard and I in the way that's I love that. I love that it's correct. And it also sounds good. It's the poeticness of it, too.
Yeah, yeah. So that's a great example of, how I keep coming up with topics after all these years.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and we are talking with the creator of Grammar Girl, Mignon Fogarty, Grammar Girl herself. If you have a grammar question, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. One other way that Glinda in Wicked, she says, I could care less. And Elphaba corrects her, I couldn't care less. Is that another good example of a proper correction?
It is. Definitely. There are all sorts of theories about people think why people say I could care less. I explain the wrong one so often that sometimes I get them confused myself. But you want to say that you could not care less, to say you have no caring left. So that's the logical way of saying it. But a lot of people say, I could care less. And some people think it started with people being ironic, right? Intentionally saying it the wrong way. Mm-hmm. Other people say that it's just hard to say that NT sound between the two mm-hmm. words, like couldn't care less, and that it's just sort of the nature of the way we simplify our sounds when we're talking, that would get dropped over time. But it bothers a lot of people.
We have Russ in Westerville on the line. Russ, what is your question for Grammar Girl?
Yes, my question is, when did way take the place of much? Like way older instead of much older? And you hear that all the time.
Yeah, you do.
Okay, thank you, Russ. Another example he gives is people say way better instead of much better. So what do you think? Is he right?
Well, I can tell you that it is an old thing because I did it in my youth. So when I first graduated from college, I was looking for temp jobs, and I'm not a morning person. And one of the temp places called me at 5:30 a.m. or something with a job, and they wanted to know if I could use Word, the word processing program. Mm. And I said, half awake, I said, oh yeah, I'm way good at Word.
Oh no.
That is still a joke to this day in my house. My husband will tease me, so you're way good at Word, right?
Yeah. I'm way good at computers. All right.
Yeah.
So
I don't think it's grammatically incorrect, but it's certainly an informal way of speaking.
Okay. So much is the more proper way.
Or very. I'm very good at Word, mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Now we have Brad in Clintonville. Brad, what's your question for Grammar Girl?
Hello, Grammar Girl. I talked to you actually a few years ago. So thanks for being on the show. And thank you, Amy, for taking calls again from the public. I appreciate it. I listen to a lot of NPR, and you hear an awful lot of people interviewing the guests on NPR. And I've noticed in the past that the first word out of the person being interviewed after they're asked a question very often used to be "so," and then they would proceed to give the rest of their answer. In the last couple of years, I've seen "so" been replaced, and now people are starting to answer the first word of their answer to a question with the word "yeah." And I've even heard this from scientists, which is especially disappointing because scientists are supposed to be more precise. And the reason this bothers me is when a scientist, or really anybody else, says "yeah" as the first word out of their mouth, very often they're saying "yeah" in the first word answer to a question being asked that's a yes or no question. So once they say "yeah," very often they don't mean "yes," which is what "yeah" used to mean to me. So just like to hear your comment on that.
All right. Well, thank you, Brad. Thank you for that question. So I just did it. I said "so" instead of "yeah." Okay. Well, Brad, you got me. Now I'm all self-conscious.
It happened. So I was going to do it as a joke and say, "Yeah, I see what you mean."
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There you go.
It's a very good point. And then I just said, "No, there." You know, it's I think that when we're speaking, especially on the spot like this, like in a radio interview, we want to give ourselves a second to think. Your brain is sort of trying to formulate a response, and we have these verbal tics that we use to give ourselves some breathing room or to work our way into a question, you know, as you're thinking it sort of through in your mind. We've written about that in the past. There have been podcasts about it. Some people think it's condescending when people start a sentence with "so." I tend to disagree, but that doesn't mean, you know, certainly people perceive it that way. I don't think everyone who does it means it that way. But I do see your point that it is a particular problem when people say "yeah," when the answer may actually be "no" once they start talking. I imagine, I would expect that if psychologists did a study on that, they would find that the initial "yeah" does somehow influence listeners' perception of the answer. I think that's a really great point. And gosh, thank you for calling again. We really appreciate that.
That's very interesting. And I've been told that I start multiple sentences with the word "now," but I think I do it to give myself a little room to figure out what question I'm trying to ask. And maybe I'm trying to not say or "like," which isn't that kind of thing. So I guess you develop these, I don't want to call it a tick, but like you develop just these things and you don't even realize it until someone points it out to you.
You do. And it's very interesting because, as I said, I've been doing interviews with experts on the podcast. And as part of that process, we make transcripts that we post with them, you know, for people who would rather read it. And so you get to see people's verbal toolbox as you're transcribing what they're saying. You know, I say "you know" a lot. Other people say "right" all the time at the end of a sentence. They'll end every third sentence with "right." You know, it's fascinating. We all have, it's sort of almost a fingerprint of our speech patterns, and everyone is a little different, but you can pretty quickly sense what a person's patterns are.
And now we have David in Clintonville. David, what is your question?
To piggyback on the last guy, I've often heard "so yeah" to begin a sentence. And occasionally I've heard "yeah, no."
Oh, yeah, no. Yeah, no is a favorite one. Yeah, no is a favorite one in the Midwest.
I don't know if I mean K-N-O-W or N-O.
It's N-O.
Oh, well, that's even worse. Yeah, no. What does that mean?
Yeah. David is correct. David is correct. That's right. Yeah, no means no.
Yeah, we did a show about that a few years ago. Mm-hmm. If I remember correctly, people think it may have started in Australia. Don't quote me on that. I'm just mining the depths of my long-term memory.
I know. No, I feel like it started in Ohio.
I think linguists may call it a discourse marker. It's something that doesn't really have a lot of literal meaning, but it serves a function in the sentence, you know, setting up the part that follows in a certain way.
So David asked specifically about the word so. Do you find that so is a word that is just a lead in? It's one of those thinking words again?
Yeah, absolutely. Trying to think of an example, you can say, so we're gonna take a break. I remember that there are many different purposes it can serve as a discourse marker like that. And it can be a signal of a changing, you know, so you could say, so we're going to go on a break now. And that's sort of a way of saying, okay, we're switching gears. It sort of, it alerts the listener that something is changing. And it does a number of different subtle things that way, in addition to just giving people time to think.
So we're going to take a break now. This is All Sides. We're talking with Grammar Girl Mignon Fogarty. Listeners, you can join us, 614-292-8513, or email allsides@wosu.org. We will have more when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. A First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This hour, we're talking with the creator of Grammar Girl, Mignon Fogarty. Listeners, if you have a grammar question, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Mignon, thanks for being here again.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
And Mignon is the author of several books about language, has New York Times bestsellers, has over 1,000 podcasts and a newsletter. Lots of stuff that you're working on. So I wanted to ask you about the 2024 Word of the Year, brain rot, which I guess is two words, but it was the Word of the Year. What did you make of that becoming a Word of the Year, brain rot, two words?
Yeah, I think it certainly fits the feeling of our time. There's so much concern that people are spending too much time online, too much time on their phones, scrolling through this and that. And people worry that their brains are rotting and that, you know, maybe that's contributed to some of the problems in the world today. So it wasn't surprising to me that brain rot was up there as a word. Multiple dictionaries, either, I can't remember which was which, but one had it as the Word of the Year and many others had it as a runner-up. It was a popular word last year.
One of the finalists, though, surprised me. It was an Old English word, lore. What is the traditional meaning of lore, and also how is it being used now?
Right, yeah. Lore is sort of the story of a character. So they're, if you're a fan of Lord of the Rings, let's say, you know all, if you're a big fan, you know all the lore. You know about Frodo and Sam and how their relationship started and has developed over time. And you know about the ring and where it came from. You know all that background information about that story and those characters. And so that's sort of traditionally how we would think of lore. And one of the reasons lore has become more popular is because of Taylor Swift's big album, Folklore. Mm. So folklore are the stories that our ancestors told, for example. But now people are using lore to describe the stories of their own lives. So, you know, you could say, well, okay, part of my lore, and Jan Fogarty's lore, is that I actually have a master's degree in biology. I was a science writer before I was Grammar Girl, and I actually did a science podcast before I was Grammar Girl. So that is something that only someone who sort of follows me closely would know. It's sort of part of my lore. And so the reason it's the word of the year is that common people, especially young people, are starting to use lore to describe their own lives, to describe the stories from their lives. So in a way, they're almost thinking about the narrative. You know, it started out as thinking about the narratives of their favorite characters, either, you know, celebrities or fictional characters from, you know, books or movies they love. And then they're thinking, well, I have lore, and this is my lore and the story of my life. And so they're using lore that way. And so that's why it's become so much more popular.
I love your lore story about being a biology major. That's awesome. So what was your podcast called back in the day, the science one?
Oh, gosh. It was called Absolute Science. Yeah. And I think I did 12 episodes, and I interviewed scientists. But and it was great. But oh, gosh, that was probably 2004, 2005.
Oh, that's even early in the podcasting world, right?
Yeah. I mean, technologically, it was very difficult just to do and record those interviews as an individual. And so it was very hard. And so I didn't do it for very long. But
I'm glad you found love in grammar now. So
I did. Yeah. Yeah.
We have Susan in Columbus. Susan, what is your question for Grammar Girl?
So about 35 years ago, I read a dystopian novel. And in that time frame, that novel, people, instead of using he, she, or they use the word person, where we would say he or she, like person is going to the store. And they used P-E-R, the first three letters of the word person, for him or her. So you'd say, is person going to the store? If so, can you tell per to pick up apples? And I was wondering if that was a lexicon we could include, because it bothers me to use the word they for the singular, but yet I want to be respectful of people's pronoun choices. And I wanted to get Mignon's feedback and thoughts on that. Thank you.
All right. Yeah. What do you think of per?
I love this question. Yeah, no, I'm a big science fiction reader myself, and science fiction is one of the places where you can find more commonly what are these are called neo pronouns, N-E-O, neo pronouns, like for new pronouns. And the interesting thing is that they actually aren't that new. You can Dennis, there's a writer. His first name is Dennis, who wrote a book called What Is My Pronoun, and has traced the use of these pronouns back at least 200 years. So, you know, English is missing this kind of general purpose pronoun that some other languages have. And so there have always been people trying to introduce an alternative to the singular they. I mean, I think speaking as, you know, someone, as I said before, who's very practical, I think the singular they clearly has won and has become our general purpose sort of generic pronoun. But these neo pronouns are so interesting. If you like that, Becky Chambers has, she uses neo pronouns in her books, which are quite delightful. Becky Chambers. And thank you. The producer just popped in and said, it's Dennis Barron. Thank you, Marcus.
Yes.
Yeah.
And okay, so now we have Lauren in Athens County. Lauren, what's your question for Grammar Girl?
It's a question of the apostrophe between it and it is, between being a possessive it's or a it's.
Do you get mixed up on when to put the apostrophe?
Yes.
All right. Yeah.
Does the possessive get it or the verb?
All right, Lauren. Yeah. I think we got you here. Go ahead.
It is a very common question. I'll tell you that I got knocked out of the second grade spelling bee because I mixed up my itses. So it's a long, longstanding thing for
Childhood trauma.
And I've figured out the reason people get confused is because we use apostrophes to make nouns possessive. So, you know, Mignon's microphone, that would be my name, apostrophe S. So we are early in grade school, we're sort of drilled with the idea that apostrophes are possessive, but it actually doesn't work that way for pronouns. pronouns have different forms to become possessive. So, you know, it's her microphone. Her is the possessive. It's not her apostrophe S. So you have to let go of that idea that apostrophes always mean possessive when you're thinking about pronouns. They don't. So when you're talking it's, the apostrophe is showing that letters have been omitted. It's a contraction. So it's for it is or it has. The apostrophe shows you're sort of combining those two words. So you're like splicing them together. And it's its with no apostrophe is the possessive pronoun. It's like hers and his and ours. So just remember that pronouns don't take apostrophes. They're different from nouns. So pronouns never take apostrophes to become possessive. That's just nouns. And I think that can help you remember.
All right. And we have an email from Brad who asks, the sentence is, a group of lawyers were in the room. But if it's a group of lawyers, shouldn't it be was? A group of lawyers were in the room.
Yeah, this is a great question, too. So when you're dealing with something like that, you are supposed to ignore the of lawyers part. So you just imagine just taking that out of the sentence. And then you have the group is in the room. It wouldn't be the group are in the room. So it is a singular, are is plural. It would be the group is in the room. Now, the complicating factor with this is it's different in British English. So if you're reading the BBC or The Economist or another British publication, you'll see it done a the other way because they tend to treat what are called collective nouns, the group, the committee, the family, the team. They treat those as plural, but in American English, we treat them as singular. So you ignore the of lawyers part. You just get rid of that prepositional phrase and you say the group. And then it is in the room, because in American English, those collective nouns are singular.
A group of lawyers is in the room. All right. Ken in Springfield. Ken, what's your question for Grammar Girl?
Hi, good morning. When talking to somebody, I hear people time to time, at the end of their sentence, it's like they've run out of steam and they use the term et cetera. And I was just wondering about the use of that term when they're describing something to you. And it's almost like they don't know anything further to add. And so they say, et cetera.
I can see et cetera in writing a lot, but actually saying et cetera out loud. What do you think of that?
Yeah, it is sort of, I guess I can see how it could be thought of as a cop out. but maybe the person just doesn't want to list all the things. I think, you know, I'm trying to think about when people would use it, and maybe they go down a path, right? They're like saying my favorite dessert is cake and sweet things, cake, cookies, etc. And they don't want to keep naming things, but they're not sure how to end the sentence because there are other things too. And that's sort of what it's for. I thought you were going to ask about the pronunciation, because a lot of people mispronounce the word and will say et cetera when it's actually et cetera, not with the X sound. So that is a common complaint that I hear.
The abbreviation is supposed to be ETC. Is that correct?
Correct.
All right. Yeah. So if you are writing I probably say it as et cetera. It's et cetera, right?
Correct.
All right. Before we run out of time, we're down to just 2 minutes left. I did want to ask you about the Constitution. I can't remember if this was a podcast or in your newsletter. You wrote about that a lot of people have been revisiting the Constitution now. Can you tell us about the original draft and what it looks like when as a grammar lover when you look at the Constitution?
It's really fun to look at it as a physical object because it has a different language than we use today. All the nouns are capitalized because that's just the way they did it. Back then, it was almost like German where nouns were capitalized, and we don't do that anymore. And actually, nobody really knows why we stopped capitalizing our nouns. It's something I've researched, tried to find the answer to, and the best I found was a sort of suggestion that it had something to do with librarians.
Oh, no, not the librarians.
Not the librarians. But it also has what's called the medial S. So if you look at old documents, some of the S's look like lowercase f's, which is just weird. And you wonder, why do they do that? And English, when we wrote it by hand, used to have this other S that was used. There are all sorts of complicated rules, but generally, if an S was in the middle of a word and sometimes at the beginning, it would be written like this lowercase f, but they would never do it at the end of a word. So at the top of the Bill of Rights, it has the Congress of the United States, and the second to the last S looks like an F. So it looks like FS at the end, but those are both S's. And we know why that went away. It was because of the development of the printing press, because printers didn't want to keep around all those different pieces for the different letters. So if they could use just one S instead of two types of S's, it made printing easier. So that's why we lost, it's called the medial S.
I want to ask you more questions about the Constitution, but we are out of time, so you'll have to come back. I will take a hard look at the Bill of Rights so I can see what you're talking about, and we'll talk about it next time. Does that sound good?
That'd be great, yeah.
All right, this is All Sides. Thank you, Mignon Fogarty, Grammar Girl. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Amy.
And this is All Sides with Amy Jurevich on 89.7 NPR News.